Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, the UK took a step toward becoming the first country in the world yesterday to legalize so-called three-parent babies when the House of Commons voted to approve a bill. If the bill passes Parliament's upper chamber, which is likely, it could become law later this year. Should the U.S. follow suit? Here with me now to explain the science and discuss the ethics is bioethicist Dr. Nita Farahani. She's professor of law and philosophy and genome sciences and policy at Duke University. Hi, Dr. Farahani. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Why do people, first of all, want to create babies out of the DNA of three people? Who will this help? What will it correct?
So there is an affliction that affects a small number of people, but when it does so quite severely, which is something called mitochondrial abnormality. The mitochondria is the part of the cell that really fuels the cell and gives the cell energy. And women who have mitochondrial abnormality in their eggs, their reproductive gametes, they have a very difficult time having healthy children. In fact, many of them have multiple miscarriages, or if they do have a child, that child suffers enormously in the first year or couple of years of life that they might survive, and then they usually die a kind of terrible and horrible death because of the way that mitochondrial abnormality affects them. So this technique that the UK House of Lords has just voted to move ahead on, and hopefully Parliament will as well, enables women who have mitochondrial abnormality to have donor mitochondria from a healthy egg donor, and as a result, to have a healthy child simply by replacing that abnormal mitochondria.
And could this process eventually mean parents will have a way of passing, a way around passing down other inherited diseases?
Maybe. So one thing that's controversial about this technique is for the kind of abnormality that we're talking about, if you think about a cell, most of what we pass on to our children and next generation lives within a tiny bundle inside of the cell called the nucleus of the cell. In fact, 99.9% of the traits that we're familiar with exist within that little nucleus. And this technique doesn't affect the nucleus, but it could. So in the past, we've never approved modifications to an egg and a sperm. There are other techniques that we've enabled, but not actual germline modification. And many people are afraid that if we start modifying what's outside the nucleus, that we may start modifying what's inside the nucleus. And so one day it might enable that, but it's a very different technique to modify the trait-bearing DNA inside the nucleus than simply changing out the mitochondria that exists outside of the nucleus in the cell.
So if this is not relevant to trait-bearing characteristics, as you just called it, does that mean the baby would not have any features of the third parent, in effect, just of the original two parents?
That's right. And so, you know, while people call it three-parent IVF, I've resisted that terminology for it because I think it takes a lot more to be either a genetic parent or a true parent in the sense that we think about that in society. So the cytoplasm would give the child the energy necessary to have healthy brain and healthy heart and healthy organs, the fuel necessary to develop normally and to develop healthily. But none of the kind of traits that we're familiar with, the eye color, the personality, the hair color, all of the things that we associate with what it means to be a person, what it means to be us, none of that would come from the third donor.
So just two names on the birth certificate.
I think that that's going to be true for a very long time to come.
Listeners, do you have questions about the process of creating a baby from the DNA of three people or questions or opinions about the ethics? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For genome science and policy professor from Duke, Dr. Nita Farahani, 212-433-9692. Do you have ethical reservations about the press process? Are you just cheering this on? 212-433-9692. Critics of the process are saying this opens the door to, quote, designer babies. How do you understand that term? And does it in this case?
So, you know, that term is thrown around a lot to suggest that If you remember the movie Gattaca, which is one of my favorite movies, I think it's terrific. It imagined a dystopian future where we pick every last trait that we can genetically for our children. And people are afraid that once we can start tinkering with our eggs and our sperm, that opens the floodgates to doing so. And I think that sells us as a society really quite short. It assumes that just because we allow one particular technique, which is universally agreed upon as a terrible health-related affliction, that suddenly we're going to, you know, go in there and start modifying eye color and hair color and make our children fast sprinters and Olympic athletes. And I think we can draw a bright line. We can say, no, we're just going to allow this change to the cytoplasm, the stuff that exists outside of that trait-bearing nucleus, and not allow the next step to proceed. And we can proceed step by step for things that we as a society are comfortable with. So I think the idea that suddenly when you make one choice, it opens the floodgates to all choices, really just doesn't reflect the kind of advancements we have in society. And it doesn't reflect the science either, because we are light years away from being able to understand the genetic contributions to traits. And we know that genetics alone doesn't reflect what we ultimately enjoy in personhood. Environment plays a huge part of that. And so, you know, we have a long way to go before we even could get to that idea of a designer baby. And I don't think this is a step on a slippery slope toward that.
Judy in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question is this. If this does not change the traits that the new baby would be carrying, let's say it's a girl, let's say she grows up, let's say she wants a baby, will she need this done again or not?
So that's a great question, which is to understand the efficacy, really, of this procedure. It depends in part on what procedure is being used. The one that the UK is contemplating, the entire cytoplasma, the entire mitochondria is replaced. And so essentially what happens is you take the nucleus from the parents of an embryo and you put it into a donor cell that has all of the cytoplasma from the donor. And as a result, when the girl grows up to be a woman and has children of her own, she has healthy cytoplasma that wouldn't be transferred on to the next generation. There was an earlier technique that we did here in the United States for a little while where you would simply inject an egg with healthy mitochondria from a donor, but leave the unhealthy mitochondria in the cell because it's the proportion of abnormality that can affect children. And that led to some concerns that either the next generation or the generation after that or later would be affected by the cytoplasma that would be carried on.
And we go from Judy in Port Washington to John in Port Washington, an issue of great interest to the North Shore, apparently. John, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Thank you. Hi, how are you?
Okay.
So I just want to comment on the ethical debate of this topic, and I'm torn with it myself. Some people say it's unethical, it's ungodly, it's not natural. And then my answer to that is, aren't human beings part of nature? Our brain developed naturally. We created electricity. We created airplanes. Why would this be then unnatural? Even though I get their point, I just wanted to, I just wanted to bring that up. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much. Thank you, God, for giving me the ability to genetically engineer.
I think John's comment is a very fair one, which is the naturalness debate that a lot of people say is when you do something that they call unnatural, they think it's wrong, it's somehow morally impermissible. But I think John's right, which is if you look at everything we do, it's unnatural using that kind of definition. Everything we do is some new change and modification from the state of nature before humans existed. And we're part of that. And so I think it's right to say both it is part of nature because we've done it and we're part of nature. And also, there's no such thing as a truly natural, untouched part of our life or our world.
His question suggests that the opposition to this would come from religious conservatives. Is that what's happening?
It's not just religious conservatives. So certainly there are some religious conservatives who are opposed to it. There are some who are in favor of it. It doesn't track exactly to a political divide. It turns out there are many people who are liberal who also feel like it's unnatural or that it opens up floodgates and slippery slopes. It's a very comfortable line for many people that have been drawn between the no germline modification, meaning no changes that would be passed on to future generations and only allow changes that would affect the current generation.
And so I guess there's a kind of progressive strain of criticism that I've heard that's likening this to GMO foods, genetically modified crops. Is that comparison apt in any way as you see it?
Sure, in some ways. I hate to compare people to food, but in the idea that, you know, changing what exists in nature and that nature, you know, does it well and that our modifications have future repercussions that we simply don't know about, that is one of the major concerns. You know, it's not just the floodgates that a lot of the people who are opposed to it are concerned about. They're worried about how you can ensure that the technique is safe. So the earlier caller who asked about whether or not it would be passed on to future generations, you know, we can't know the consequences for future generations until future generations come to life. And so that's a scary prospect for many people to enable a technology that does that. And yet we have in vitro fertilization and we improve that without knowing what the future implications and consequences would be as well. There are many things that we can't know, and yet we still have to proceed in the face of progress.
To that point, I think, Hirsch in Rockland County. Hirsch, you're on WNYC.
Hi, I think I missed the previous caller who may have asked a similar question about previous generations. I was on with the screener, but my question is about this particular individual who will be born from this procedure. Will not the cell itself be the multiplying of that cell will be determined by the DNA that's in the nucleus of the cell and not by the cellular material, the mitochondria that's in the original egg cell?
And why do you ask that question? Are there ethical implications to that or personhood implications?
No. This isn't an ethical one, more of a scientific one, in the sense that will that cell be viable? Will it develop viably as if you know, anything had happened? Won't the future, you know, cells that are reproduced be the same cell that it was before the DNA was put into this other?
I see the question. Yeah. So no is the short answer. So the nucleus doesn't determine the cytoplasm of the cell. The cytoplasm is like the fluid in the cell that has the energy producing mitochondria that surrounds the nucleus. And that's passed down just from the mother because it exists only in the egg cells. And so from one generation to the next, it's passed down through the egg cells in the maternal line. Taking the nucleus out of the maternal egg and putting it into a new donor egg that has the nucleus removed means that the cytoplasm of the new cell is what's used to fuel the energy for reproduction. So it's the nucleus remains intact, but the new cytoplasm is what's used from the donor cell rather than the nucleus sending some sort of signal to create new cytoplasm.
We're talking for just another few minutes with bioethicist Nita Farahani about what they approved in the UK yesterday in Parliament, and that is the right of parents to take DNA from, in effect, a third parent to correct a certain kind of abnormality, mitochondrial abnormality, that usually results in the horrific death of a baby in its first year of life. This is being dubbed the technology of three parents or three parent babies. Our guest has been explaining why she doesn't actually accept that slang, because it doesn't actually affect any of the traits or characteristics of the baby. It just affects the nature of the mitochondria. Is that the right way to say it?
That's right. And it's worth noting, Brian, that The FDA in this country, the Food and Drug Administration, held hearings on a very similar technique and whether or not the U.S. would move forward with approving mitochondrial transfer here for women who and couples who are afflicted with this problem in conceiving and having healthy children. And so far, they haven't approved moving ahead on it. They have noted that they have safety concerns about future generations and the technique itself, how it would affect the next generation. And there hasn't been an ethical analysis that's been done by any body here in the United States like it has been done in the UK. So the UK really vetted this procedure through both their scientific council as well as their ethical council before it moved to the House of Lords. And I think they're taking a leadership role in the world and really trying to understand the scientific merit of this technique and the ethical mandate, really, to make this kind of technology available to couples and women who are afflicted with this so that they can have healthy children of their own.
Jim in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Thank you. Hi, do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. My question is about class. I don't hear any discussions, ethical or otherwise, about economic access to these technologies. So will these technologies, this and others, be available to people who can afford them, especially in a place like the United States, where healthcare is driven by economic access, and the rest of us will continue to have, children that will die of these diseases while the rich will not?
How would it be different, Jim, in that respect, and how would you level the playing field from any other kind of health treatment or fetal developmental treatment?
Well, I don't have an answer, but I know here in the United States, for instance, if you have, good health insurance or a lot of money, you have access to all kinds of technologies that if you're on, let's say, Obamacare or Medicaid, you do not. So will this be another example of how the rich will have, access to technologies that will, enable their children to be healthy, vital, get rid of genetic diseases, mm-hmm. while you'll have a sort of two-tier type of human being, while, the rest of us will simply have to suffer from these diseases because we can't have access to the technologies. That's my question. I don't have an answer to it.
Thank you. Dr. Farhani?
So one thing that is also quite different about the UK system than the US system is it is a technology that's available across society because of their healthcare system. And so IVF technology, reproductive technologies are available to really everybody in their society. And this technology, like all other technologies in the United States, have concerns about distributive justice is what we call it in the ethical term, which is access. And access across the board. So the caller is right, which is this technology certainly is only going to be available in the beginning to people who can afford it, and that does create a continued gap. That's true for all of the reproductive technologies here in the United States, which is people who want to have healthy children of their own and can use something like in vitro fertilization generally don't have health insurance reimbursement and have to pay out of pocket, and it's extraordinarily expensive. And that's a technology that isn't available across the board. So, that's an ongoing debate in this country, not just for this kind of technology, but for all medical care, expensive medical care and other technologies, which is how are we going to ensure that there's fair and equitable access across the board?
Dr. Nita Farhani, Professor of Law and Philosophy and Genome Sciences and Policy at Duke University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Schaefer and Schwartz on Dylan and Sinatra. Stay with us.